morning. The Senate Interim Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Welcome. Today, we're going to go out of order. We'll do the introduction of committee concepts, committee legislative concepts at the end after we hear about the committee legislative concepts. We have a number of items on the agenda today and a number of items on the agenda for February. And Cheyenne pointed out that it would be worth noting to people, do not plan to take that three-day weekend in February, which is, I believe that's President's Day. Our committee will be meeting that day. We need that day to get through our work. So please come.
Wait a minute. There's mandatory sick time. And
you cannot use it for a holiday. You have to actually be sick. Otherwise, we can discipline you, Senator Olson. All right. With that, we're going to open up our first informational meeting, which is an update on the governor's external review for safety in children's residential care. And that's Clyde.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Interim Administrator for the Department of Human Services. So while I'm really happy to be here this morning, I will tell you that we did have a contingency plan if I had the winning lottery ticket last night. But obviously, by my presence here, I was not one of the winners. And so we'll have to continue to keep working. As you know, the governor asked me to step in as interim director of the Department of Human Services in November and tasked me with a number of things that she wanted me to work on. And one of the things that she wanted done was to establish a independent third-party review of the child welfare system. And so I'm here this morning to kind of just give you an idea of where, an update of where we are and answer any questions that you may have. So, as you know, it's been a difficult time at the department over the last probably 6 months to a year. And I will tell you that some of the things that have come to light and some of the things that we found have really had an impact on staff, have definitely had an impact on the children in our care, and really had impacts on just the whole foster care system in general, including providers, stakeholders, advocates. And I don't think any of us feel that we are where we need to be or we should be. And so part of the process of identifying what the issues are and how to move forward to remedy these issues will be the independent third-party review that the governor has asked for. So we have run a procurement process, and the Department of Administrative Services actually ran the process. We didn't do it internally to DHS. And have identified a vendor to come in and work with us. Right now, we are in negotiations with the vendor. Hopefully, have a contract in the next couple of weeks, and then they can begin their work. An important part of the process is that we've established an advisory committee made up of a number of different parties. Senator Gelser and Senator Winters are part of that committee, as well as Representative Stark and Representative Peluso. We also have members from the provider community, the tribes, the African-American community, and advocates and stakeholders. And I think one really important part of the committee is we also have two individuals who are actually what I would call alumni of the foster care system. These are two individuals who actually were part of the foster care system. And what we found so far in our meetings is that their input and the perspective that they've provided has really been invaluable in helping us shape where we're going to go and what we're going to do. So there, we've had two committee meetings so far, and what I wanted to share with you are just a few takeaways or a few really important points that I think have come out of the discussion in those committee meetings. The first, and we all agree on this, the assessment will probably take about 6 months. But during the course of the assessment, we are probably going to find things that are what you would call low-hanging fruit or no-brainers. And as those things are identified, we are going to implement them right away. We're not going to wait till the report is finished and wait for the entire six-month period before we actually start implementing and making improvements in the system. The other part of the assessment that I think is very important is we are asking the contractor to schedule a series of face-to-face meetings with a wide and diverse group of people, legislators, providers, DHS staff, foster children, advocates, like the CASA programs, and really want them to get a very holistic and diverse view of what the system looks like and where the problems are. We also want them to help us look at the metrics we use, because we want to make sure that we're measuring the right things and that we have the right indicators that tell us we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, and that we're accomplishing the results and outcomes that we need to be. We've also asked them to look at confidentiality. It's always a big issue. I really want to understand the parameters of how much information, what type of information we can share with people, and to be sure that, I'm sure some people feel this, we're not using confidentiality as kind of a shield or curtain to hide behind. So finally, the final point I'd like to make, and then I'll be happy to take any questions, is it's very important that we guard the independence of the contractor that's doing this review. Even the perception that DHS is trying to influence their work, I think, damages the credibility of the work in the report. And so we are really working hard to keep kind of that arm's length distance between us and whoever the contractor is going to be. They will have to talk to our staff, but our staff's role really is to present information and help them gather the data that they're going to need to come up with their recommendations. And so with that, let me stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Sanderson.
Thank you for coming. I am very worried about the children that are in foster care right now that might be experiencing some of the same problems that were experienced in the past. And I would hope that the agency would be, the case managers, the supervisors, will be taking a look at the complaints that have come in. I mean, if someone is being denied food, if someone can't go out and buy their tampons because they've been a bad girl, and therefore, and she thinks, well, she is a bad girl. I mean, I am extremely concerned about our kids right now in foster care.
Right.
So what is the agency doing about those in the system right now?
Right. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Montes-Anderson. So I share your concern, and we can't wait 6 months. We can't even wait 1 month or 1 week to be sure that we're doing all we can to keep children safe. So one of the things I noticed, and I think I may have shared this with some of you, is that when I looked at the way we were assessing concerns or complaints or issues with providers, it was a very siloed system, and there was really no methodical way that we took complaints about providers and looked at that in a holistic way to be sure that we did or didn't have issues that we needed to be addressed. And what I've done is established a internal work group, and what we do is we meet twice a month, and as complaints come in, we actually get representatives from each of the parts of the foster care system or provider system that are responsible for making sure that providers are doing what they should be doing. So, for instance, we have people from licensing. We have people from OAPI, which is our abuse investigation unit. We have financial people. We have program people. And I also sit in on those meetings. And what we do in those meetings is really look at issues or concerns or complaints that have come up. And then in the group, staff those issues, talk about what we're going to do to address those issues, and then talk about how we're going to monitor on an ongoing basis what the performance of the provider is. And, you know, I think that having that kind of discussion actually has been really helpful. And you may or may not know that we've actually, since we formed that group, made decisions on a couple providers, and because we were concerned about the lack of care that they were providing.
So, Clyde, how is that different? I mean, I think we've all seen many, many public records, and what was disturbing to me was both in my office and this hearing room, DHS staff said that DHS didn't know about these things, that people personally didn't know about these things. It's very clear in the records that the agency, the appropriate people, and individuals that sat in this room and said that they didn't know were key parts of many conversations about these very specific allegations, and that there were multiple meetings about this provider in which very shocking and disturbing details were provided, in which anybody should have known that kids weren't safe.
Yeah.
So besides you being in the agency, what's different, and why should we expect a better outcome for children?
So, Chirugel, sorry, I think that's a very good question, because I think for whatever reason, one of the pieces that I felt was missing was really a kind of a clear, defined process on how you make decisions on what kind of action to take against a provider. I mean, you know, I've kind of used the phrase with staff, okay, enough is enough, we're done here. We're going to issue a letter or an intent to revoke. And I don't think that there really was a kind of a clear understanding of, so who makes that final decision, and where who decides where the line is drawn. And I guess I would share with you that kind of given what I've heard and given what I've seen, I've come to the conclusion that that's my responsibility. I have to understand what the issue is, and I have to instruct staff to say, yes, we're going to work with them, but if these things don't happen, then we're done, and here's what we're going to do. And so I think, you know, that to me is part of it. It really is having the process or the person who says, this is where the line is, and this is what we're going to do, and we're not going to go past that.
Do you feel confident that your staff is empowered and held accountable to be completely forthcoming in those? I mean, even looking recently, I was informed by the department that all of the children had been, DHS children had been immediately removed from youth villages, and then 2 weeks later it turned out none had been. I mean, that's not a communication error. That is a severe factual error. So how can you make those decisions, and how can we have confidence that we can trust DHS given false statements that have been given in this committee to the media and in offices, not just once, but over and over again about very serious issues related to child safety?
So, Chair Gelser, we have had a number of unfortunate incidents, and I will share with you that I was just as frustrated because I was given the same information, and I think I was the one who shared the information with you, and then later was told that information wasn't correct. So, really, again, what it comes down to is I have to be very clear about what my expectation is for people in how we share information, how we present information, how we verify that what we're telling people is accurate. And I will tell you that, again, if I have made the expectation clear, if people don't make the expectation, then for me it's kind of a personnel issue, and I'll have to make some changes. But in the end, I'm accountable to you. And so, you know, it's really not the people under me who you have to trust and have to have confidence in. I think it's, I'm the person that, and if I'm, you have to hold me accountable. And if it's not happening, then we'll need a new director.
And I mean, you're an interim. What happens when you go? I mean, I think the other thing, and I know we'll have other folks up here to talk about it later, but I mean, the statute is pretty clear about what's required in terms of providing services, including that a provider can't provide services without a license.
Right.
And certainly child welfare should not be placing children in an unlicensed facility. And what we've learned from these records is that your own licensing people were saying this provider has been, I think one of the quotes is, this provider has been operating a residential program for years without a license. So what's the point of even having licensing if the department is going to place vulnerable kids in their care in violation of law with a provider that has no license to provide that care? And what was missing in the system that would make someone think they didn't have the authority to protect kids by following what's very clear in statute for years?
Mm-hmm. So Chair Gelser, you know, I'm still in the process of kind of ferreting out what happened and why we got to where we got to. The important thing is that while I'm there, as I try to institute changes and try to change the culture, I have to figure out a way to actually institutionalize it so it doesn't matter who's in that office. The work actually gets done. And I would be the first to admit, and I've said this to the committee before, There are cultural, system, and personnel issues that have to be addressed. And until those things are addressed, I'm not confident that we'll be able to do what we need to do. And so that's my job, to address those issues.
And I think going back to Senator Monis Anderson's issue that there's people that are there, we've now known about these issues for months. It just seems like every week that passes, we find out that the problem is even bigger. What is the timeline for those cultural and personnel changes?
Well, we've already started some, you'll see more coming in the near future. But I also want to make sure that it's my job also to make sure that I'm making the right changes and making the right decisions. The one thing I don't want to do is make it worse. My goal, as I'm there as an interim director, is to leave it in a better place than when I came in. And that's what I try to do every day.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and thank you for allowing me to sit in with you guys for a few minutes. Clyde, can you, just for the record, share for anyone who's watching or watches later, if they want to, where do they find the information on the committee that we've been on that we're referencing that's dealing with all this information? If they want to track that, how
sure.
do they find that information?
Absolutely.
And also, would you talk, I didn't hear you mention, to my understanding, one of the goals is, even though you've said you expect this to be a six-month process with that committee, that doesn't mean we're waiting six months to implement things. So can you talk about both of those things a little
sure.
bit?
Sure, sure. So I'm very bad at, they don't let me touch any machinery, like even copy machines. I'm told not to touch them because every time I do, the technician will come in and say, wow, I've never seen that before. How did you do that? Janine, is it, we have a website, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, excuse me, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Representative Stark. We do have a website. We post the minutes of the meeting. We post the agendas. I think also there are profiles of the members of the advisory committee. So anybody who's interested absolutely could avail themselves of the information on the website. And, I would be happy to talk to anybody about it, too, and share information that they would like about the committee. We do think that as we go along, we will find that the person who's doing the independent review will come to us and say, you know, we've really been looking at this area here, and have you ever thought about doing this, or this might be something you want to consider. And what our plan is the independent or the advisory committee will be meeting on a regular basis with the contractor, and they will be presenting things like that to the committee, and we'll vet that end at the committee. And if it seems like there are things that we can start working on or implement process system changes right away, I don't want to wait the 6 months before we get a final report to actually start on that. So, Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, with your permission, there's one more piece I forgot to share with the committee that I'd like to. So I've said all along that, you know, this isn't a six-month project and then we're done and we think we're finished with our work. This, to me, is actually only the first step. We have to look at our systems, our process, our staff on an ongoing basis. And we have to be in a mode of saying, we need to be in a mode of continuous improvement. We need to monitor what we're doing on a continuous basis. And we need to make improvements every step of the way. If anyone thinks that we're going to get to the end of this 6 months process and implement the recommendations and be done in the systems, going to be highly functional, I would hate to disappoint them. But to me, this is a first step on a longer journey and a continuous journey in which we every day should be looking at the system and saying, is it working the way it should be? And are we doing everything in our power to serve the kids who are in our care?
Madam Chair. I appreciate the fact that you've been put into a very tenuous situation. If you would correlate this to software, we have a corrupted file someplace. How deep have you gone in the software? Have you gone to the foundation of your agency and started at the bottom and looked at the files, the people that work down there to see that they're functional and they're working as they should, reporting as they should, and then stepped up the ladder? Or have you got that in-depth peeling apart the onion
right
to see what your agency looks like?
Sure. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I've done a deep dive in some areas, but not in all areas. For instance, let me give you an example. So one of the areas I've been talking to our staff about is training. How do we train the people, the child welfare staff who are actually on the ground doing the work? And one of the things I notice is we do a very good job and send them to a very intensive training when we first hire them, probably for the first 6 months or so. But what I noticed and what I've talked to people about and actually had some staff raise this to my attention is that we really don't do much in the way of follow-up after that initial 6 months training. And I think we're really missing the boat there. Because when you're a new person and you go through an intensive 6 month training, you don't know what you don't know. And really, when it kind of comes to you that, wow, you know, this is an issue, how do I deal with this, is when you get out in the field and you actually start doing the work. And so what I've been talking to staff about is we need to bring people in after the first year, maybe after the second year and third year, and kind of refresh their training and also give them a chance to really kind of talk about what the real life situations are they're facing and provide them support, technical assistance, and mentoring in how to deal with those situations. So. Yeah, there are some pretty fundamental flaws that I found. Have not had the chance to do the deep dive in every area because I'm also trying to take a look at not just child welfare, but we have four other programs that we're responsible for. And so I'm really trying to take a look at those programs to see where we are and what improvements need to be made and what some of those fundamental issues might be.
Follow up. Because of the situation we're in, and you are the director, mm-hmm. Have you told lower level personnel that if there is a problem, you can come directly to mm-hmm. you? And then if that problem is brought forth, how do you react to it and what do you do to respond?
So, Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, so as you know, I worked in the department prior to my being appointed as the interim director. And I would say that during my tenure at DHS, the last four as deputy director, I'm fairly comfortable in saying that staff felt that they could come and talk to me at any point in time about any issue and have made the same offer since my return. as staff bring me issues, I really make my best effort and typically will do this, will respond or talk to that staff person individually and pass it off to someone else, because I feel that if they take the initiative to raise an issue to me, then it's my responsibility to meet with them and talk about what the issue is and to get their feedback. Now, are all the employees comfortable with sharing that kind of information with me? Probably not. But I will tell you that almost on a daily basis, I get emails from people within the department and a lot of them who I've worked with in the past, offering input or feedback or asking me to look into something or asking me why we're doing something a certain way and offering suggestions on how we can do it better. So that's kind of the environment I'm trying to set. I want them to feel like they can come to me and talk about anything at any time.
Follow-up. Since I'm new to the committee, what you said you were the deputy director of VHS. When was that?
It was 2006 through 2010. Yeah, I left the department in 2010.
So do you think these problems that we've encountered have precipitated since 2010, or were you in there overseeing some of the stuff that was going wrong?
So I was, Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, I was involved in operations, so worked very closely with all the program areas. I guess my assessment would be that at the point in time that I was there, we had these types of discussions. But they weren't at the same frequency or intensity that we're having now.
I might be wrong in this, but Give Us This Day has gone on for quite some time. Mm-hmm. It was prior to 2010, right? So you were there when that was going on. Did you know that Give Us This Day was a problem?
So Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, I was peripherally involved. I was given information, but it was not something that I directly worked on. That was handled at a different level in the department, and I wasn't directly involved in any of the decisions.
I'm glad you mentioned that. So yeah. now mm-hmm. that you were there and you said you were not involved peripherally and you were the deputy director, mm-hmm. how do we get through this abyss that we're in? Because as the deputy director, if you were just on the periphery of this, mm-hmm. Who's the one that's going to have their hands on it and fix it if it's not the director or the deputy director? Let me rephrase that. How do you plan to make an agency that has people that can actually do this if a deputy director is sitting off to the side and not doing anything? Yeah. How do you plan to fix it so that these people can make these repairs,
sure.
let everything know?
So Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, so remember the department then was different, right? Because we hadn't had the DHS-OHA split. So really at that point in time, the department had 10,000 employees and was responsible for the full range of human services, including Medicaid. Okay. And because of that, there was, I don't want to call it a separation of duties, but there are areas of responsibility that everyone in the department had, and it would have been very difficult for any one person to have a full range of knowledge of every one of the programs and the issues in the department. I think part of the issue now is that the department is a little bit smaller, and while it's still large, it's a little bit more manageable because of the separation with OHA. And the only way I can answer your question is this. So I have to make it my business to be responsible and to be accountable. And that's the only way, in my mind, it's going to get fixed. And I have to be very hands-on. I have to be direct. I have to be very clear to my staff what my expectations are. And if people, and I have to hold people accountable. And if I'm not doing that, then it's up to you and the governor to hold me accountable. And I get that.
And I really appreciate the work that you've done and the level of focus, openness, no excuses that you've brought to this. I think seeing the changes in terms of letters of intent to revoke of a couple of programs, I understand there's a third program that's being worked on right now. That alone, I think, is a change in who the director is. We had testimony in this committee that the department didn't have the authority to make those kinds of changes. Mm-hmm. We haven't changed the law yet, and your leadership has allowed that to happen. Do you, given the role that you sit in right now, do you feel that all of the children that are in the care of the state today on January 14th, 2016 are safe today?
So Chair Gelser, no. I mean, there's no other way I can answer that question. I think we're working very hard to be sure we get to that place, but if you were the way you've asked that question, I can't answer that question, yes. And that is something that bothers me and something that keeps me up at night.
Chair, thank you. Just to follow up on that, so in terms of what is impeding child safety, I mean, how much of it is the internal processes? How much of it is the lack of places, safer places to send the children? You know, if you could speak a little bit to that challenge, which I think is part of our long-term challenge.
Yeah, so Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Denbrough, I think that's a great question because while we need to hold providers accountable, and we need to have that line to say enough is enough, and we really have to take stronger action, you know, the system is not built in a way where we have unlimited number of options in which to place children. You know, I have examples and I have heard from staff where we've actually had some of our staff have to spend the weekend in the office with a child because we don't have an appropriate placement for the child. So that, to me, is one of our challenges, you know. Unfortunately, when you get in a situation like this, the focus is really on the providers who we're having issues with. I would submit to you that we have some very good, high-functioning, professional, caring providers out there. They're out in your communities who are doing a great job. And we have providers out there who are very well-intentioned, want to do the right thing, but are not at the place right now where they can be as high-functioning as they can. And so part of our responsibility and our job is to take those types of providers and provide them with the mentoring, technical assistance, and support on an ongoing basis so they can get to the level that we need them to be at, and quite frankly, to get to the level that they want to be at. But, you know, in talking to members of the provider community, they are just as concerned about the bad actors as we are. They are just as concerned about child safety as we are. And in the discussions I've had with them, they are very much interested in supporting where we want to go and partnering with us in creating a system in which we can hold people accountable, but we can also provide the assistance support to the people, you know, who are struggling, but who are very well-intentioned, who have the best interests of the kids at heart, but they just need some help to get there.
Mm-hmm. I just have one.
Go ahead.
Senator Montes Anderson.
When you do the training for the foster care homes, are there do's and don'ts that they are instructed on, like never denying food, never denying essential necessities for hygiene? I mean, are those the types of things? Because I know parenting skills are, there's a broad spectrum.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering what types of guidelines on the parenting skills that you have for foster care workers.
So Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Montes Anderson, if it's okay with you, as part of the next discussion, Lois Day, who's the administrator of the Child Welfare Program, is going to be joining me at the table, and I would have her kind of talk about that, if that's okay.
Let over into the next. Yes.
don't get me wrong, I didn't mean to excoriate you on the fact that you were there when this was going on. I like the fact that you were there and you saw the dysfunction of the function, and that you now have the knowledge and the background to be able to say this needs to slide into this place and that. And I really appreciate what you've done, because you have moved the program forward. And I think it's very important that you're there to make this go. And you know, you understand that when you leave, someone has to be able to slide in and be able to play the same game as you did.
Exactly.
And I really appreciate that. But I guess the thing that concerns me is the fact that, you know, are we going to clean house? And if we do, or is it going to be fast enough? And number two, when we do get everything back in order, will there be other people out there to say, well, this is a functioning company now that we can do business with, and you'll be able to bring more people in? Do you see that in the future?
So Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Wilson, thanks for those comments. That is my ultimate goal, is really to get it to the place where people look at DHS and say, yes, they are doing what they need to do. They are functioning in the way they should, and that would be a great place to go to work. It's a great environment with good leadership and good people. I will tell you right now, and I tell everybody I speak to about this, the staff at DHS are some of the most caring and compassionate and dedicated people in state government, who do jobs that, quite frankly, are some of the hardest in state government, and quite frankly, who do jobs that I couldn't do. When I look at what our child welfare protective service workers and our adult protective services workers do and the kinds of things they see and deal with every day, I personally could not do that job. Do not have what it takes to do those kinds of functions. And so we owe it to them, not just to the clients. So you know, our number one responsibility is to the clients we serve and the people in our care. But we owe it to the people who work for the department to have an environment in which they feel supported and safe, and they feel that they have the tools that they need to do the really, really tough jobs that they need to do.
Yes, I appreciate that comment very much. Just going back to my earlier question about the capacity to get kids where they need to be and developing that side of things, is that something that the review committee is taking on as one of its charges? Is there a sort of structure and deliverable as far as that part of the problem goes?
So, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Dembro, we are still in the process of, and the advisory committee is really going to help shape this, what the scope of the work of the contractor will be. But I will tell you that I think that's a very important piece. That capacity issue leads to just a host of other issues. And unless we deal with that issue, we are not going to make the progress or get to where we need to get to. So I appreciate the question and very much agree with you.
Thank you.
Clyde, would you say that in that discussion about capacity, might you be prepared either through that committee or from the department in general to come back to the legislature in the coming months prior to the development of next year's budget, so we can have a very real conversation about provider reimbursement rates and what the outcomes are, that we're not just looking for a place to stick a kid so they're safe. We are looking to provide care and support so that they can meet their goals and be successful, and that's not free.
Yeah. Chair Gelser, I think that would be a great discussion to have. Would love to have it with you, and would love to involve the provider community and provider groups in that discussion too. Their input and participation is going to be critical in us addressing this issue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I think Senator Montes Anderson had a question about training around hygiene and access to food. Like, are there basic instructions that are given to people that are caring for kids?
Chair Gelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director of the Department of Human Services. And Senator Montes Anderson, I have to say I did not review the certification training prior to coming in here. And I believe there are I can't respond specifically to your question. There are some things that are so obvious, they may not be being said. But what I can commit to is to getting the curriculum to every member of the committee by tomorrow so that you can review that. One of the dynamics we have in this situation is that the foster homes that are a part of a residential program are not certified by the department. They're certified by the residential program, and they're required to meet the standards of the department, but they train those foster homes. And that's something we've been in conversation with Senator Gelser about. Is that the right design to ensure the quality of the foster homes that are providing care for these children that have special needs?
Just follow up. I know in the school districts, I mean, they have strict guidelines on discipline in the schools, and some think it's too lax. I think it's important to have some guidelines with the basics, because from the examples that have been provided us of what these foster, what in certain, most of foster care is good. I want to make sure everyone knows that, because I have had very good experiences when I'm on the campaign trail knocking on doors and say, oh, come in and meet my foster care child, and having wonderful interactions. That's one thing. But I am concerned that there are the bad apples, and unfortunately, I think we need to have guidelines that put certain criteria that there's a line that you don't cross. I mean, physical violence is one. Denying of nutrition and food is another. And so the fact that we have examples of that happening, had happened, I think it's important to maybe set some guidelines down, because most people, it's common sense, but others.
Chair Gelser, Senator Moniz Anderson, I know that in the training, disciplines, at least in the DHS training, discipline is specifically addressed, and you're not allowed to use any kind of corporal punishment. In the home study process, we ask prospective foster parents if they use corporal punishment on their own children, so that we understand their philosophy of parenting. But it is prohibited to use corporal punishment of any sort on a foster child, or humiliation or isolation as a discipline technique. And you're right, we see that is not always the case. I want to take some responsibility, Chair Gelser, to you from some of the information you received from us. And I was the person who said we had moved all the children when in fact we hadn't. And I've had some very, I think, direct conversation with some of my staff around how information is transmitted to us and the need for it to be accurate and not perhaps hopeful or wishful or what we're planning. Honestly, we've had some conversation around some of the issues in the department being cultural and structural, and I think there is some culture of laxness in certain areas. So with the conversation around where children moved from that facility, there was some complexity around how children got there. It was a shared mental health child welfare program. There were voluntary cases there. There were court-ordered cases, and there were private pay cases there. And in that complexity, the person that gave me information looked at the paid cases and said, these are the youth in the paid cases. So, but I didn't have that detail. That was the laxness, and I take responsibility for that. And so when you received information those children had been moved, they had, but then we found more, because when I went back and said, now, all of these children are gone, and they had gone upstairs and talked to the folks in mental health and said, well, wait a minute, we have some others. So that is, I think that's part of the culture we really have to address, and that's some pieces we've started already saying no. Another piece I want to take responsibility for is I'm someone who came to you and said I didn't know some of these things were happening. And it's been very humbling for me to pore through the thousands of pages of emails over the past several years and understand different times I was given information. And in the great volume of things that we do in a day, I didn't have that memory. And one of the things we have to put in place is what Director Psyche has been talking about, is a structural system where we have a record of what we know, what we agree we're going to do about it, and what the outcome of that action is, especially in situations such as this. So both professionally and personally, it's been a very humbling and difficult experience having all that accumulated information for me to review. So I appreciate the request. It's something that I take very seriously, my veracity, especially with legislators. So I want to take responsibility for that.
And I appreciate those comments very much. I think what is confusing and difficult, and what's been frustrating about accessing these records over the last couple weeks, kind of at the end of all these conversations that we've had, is that I don't think there's anybody that thinks what happened is okay to these kids. I don't think there's anybody that doesn't find that information to be completely shocking. What is confusing to me is I still don't think we got to the root of what it was that's going on, because what I saw in there wasn't just information that came back and forth, but sustained significant conversations across all of those entities within the department about a provider that was a problem, and people saying, but we can't do anything about this particular provider. Let's make this provider feel better. Let's get this provider an extra check. I mean, it never seemed like the focus went back to the kids, and I still can't figure out what that element is that would allow, are you required to place children in an entity that doesn't have a license? I mean, I know Donna can't revoke a license that doesn't exist, so that's not a licensing issue. How does child welfare place a child in a place that doesn't have a license? And that information was clearly shared, or the investigators saying, we've got to stop sending kids here. It's not safe. And, you know, everybody was on those emails. So what was the problem? Because it wasn't nuggets. It was very direct with allegations that were very shocking and extreme. And I'm worried we're not going to fix it until we can understand why was everybody so afraid to protect these children within this particular agency.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I think that's a really good question, and one that we've been struggling to answer. And I believe that emails tell part of the story, because there was a lot of conversation. And I think if you follow the emails, sometimes, at least for myself, what I found is sometimes I was in the email chain and sometimes I wasn't. And I can't figure out when I would fall out and when I would fall in, and what had happened during that interim when I was out. And that's what has been so sobering for me around pouring through those documents, is that things being brought to my attention at certain times and not at other times, or being included in a chain at certain times and not at other times. I think we had many conversations about child safety in this program, and part of our structure, which worked against us, was the separation of investigations from the entity that placed and removed kids and from the entity that licensed those facilities. So I think there's a document you had around allegations that were screened out, and allegations that were addressed and not found to be true, but then subsequent, because of your work, people have come forward to verify that, in fact, they were true. So what is it about the way we're doing our investigations? I was relying on the investigations. I think many of us were. How can we look at how we're doing our investigations so they're either broader or include more people? How can we fix that and not rely on people coming forward years later saying, yeah, that did happen, in fact, or even saying that in an investigation and not having enough additional investigation to determine if the veracity is actually with the reporter or with the program. This is also not the only program we have had conversations about. And so I think it gives a little bit of a siloed view of this one program, but we also had conversations about other programs and struggles they may be having, just as Director Psyche said, that really want to do a good job and need some assistance in getting there. So we do have part of our culture is to how can we help these providers get what they need so that they can provide quality care and treatment for our children. We have that about, I think that's part of our culture that we actually should retain, but perhaps do differently so that we can identify those that are not should not be providing, and those that should but need extra assistance.
So Chair Gelser, very great question, great point. I've just come to the conclusion that a couple things. Number one, we have to maybe develop a threshold in which we say if a provider goes over that threshold, it doesn't matter what political consequences are. It doesn't matter what any factors are. They can't serve our children. And number two, I still firmly believe the responsibility for making that call lies on my shoulders. And I have to make that call. And if I don't make the right call, then I should be held accountable.
Well, and I guess that goes to the question. You weren't the director at the time. And in those emails there, you know, it's referenced meetings that were going to the Director of Human Services. That was Erin Kelly Seal at the time. And it says, this is going to be Erin's call. You've got licensing saying we should do something. You've got investigations. Did Erin tell you that you couldn't revoke licenses or restrict admissions? Did you have the support that you needed to take the action that you thought was appropriate in your professional judgment?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donna Keddy. I'm the Director of the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight for Department of Human Services. Senator Gelser, in response to your question, I was never directed to not take action against a program. I think that as Lois and Clyde have said, you know, we existed in a culture of support to providers and of, you know, taking action in first and foremost to protect children. But I think, you know, part of the inherent way that we have looked at things or have taken action is, at least from the licensing perspective, when we act largely on the results of abuse investigations. And if an abuse investigation is founded, frequently it is an abuse against an individual employee of a provider. So our actions largely were focused on working with the provider to train staff or to get rid of staff, quite honestly, to find their path to termination of an employee or removal of an employee who was founded for having committed an act that was against their policy. I think that one of our failings was looking at the collective picture of an organization over time. And as Lois and Clyde have both said, as you look at these facilities taking the opportunity, as we have with Give Us This Day, to look over a number of years, you see a pattern that is even that much more disturbing. Addressing the entirety of the systemic change versus the kind of scalpeled approach I think we've had in our isolated offices will make a significant difference. So what Clyde has initiated is already making a significant difference for us in our ability to have multiple offices of the agency sit down together and look at the many facets that we historically have been shooting emails to each other about, but not having a pointed, planful, and retrospective look at what's happening with a provider.
Without going into really concise detail, could you give me an overview of if there was a complaint? Obviously, there's several different kinds, foster child abuse, staff abuse, improper payments or in not feeding or whatever. Could you give me a brief overview of the process as to once an investigator or one of the people in the field determines there's something wrong, where would that go and how would that be disseminated and how did it filter through the system so that everybody was aware of it, or was it so tightly compartmentalized that only one or two people knew about it, nobody else did? Could you give me an idea, not what you look to want to do in the future, but what actually transpired in the past, how that process worked? Could you explain that?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I can offer some comments about the investigation piece, and if we need more clarity, we have someone here from Oahu who can also add more detail. If a call is received about an allegation of abuse or impropriety, if you will, in a residential or licensed facility, the call comes through the child welfare screening but isn't screened there. It's then forwarded to the screener for our OWAPI program, and they make a determination of whether or not there's going to be an investigation. It could be closed at screening, or and they have an expanded screening process, so some telephone calls, interviews may occur in the screening process. If it's then referred for investigation, the investigator engages the program and conducts the investigation and makes their determination of whether it was substantiated, unsubstantiated, or unable to be substantiated, and those may not be their legal terms. And then licensing concerns were forwarded, the reports forwarded to the licensing department and to the individual caseworker for that child. One of the things we learned was that it wasn't forwarded to central office programs. So I didn't receive them, and I think I should. We also didn't receive when a case would not be investigated but would be screened out. We didn't receive that information. I receive that now because I think that's important. I receive a memo from the field every time there's an allegation in a child welfare foster home, and it's important we be aware at my level when we have allegations in facilities as well. But that didn't start happening until recently. So it would go to licensing, and then there may be licensing action, and I'll let you take it from there, that would be taken on the basis of what's found in the investigation done by the OWAPI investigator.
Can I interject a moment? Apparently there's several different levels of abuse that can go on. Each one is different. Like, for example, a child doesn't get fed, or the building is dirty, or something like that. Are these all handled the exact same way, going to the same people, or does the person that takes the call or takes the complaint, do they determine that, oh, I need to send this over to these folks, I need to send this to those folks, rather than saying that everybody that's involved with this particular organization knows what just came in? So in other words, if there's three different kinds of complaints, they don't go to three different places, they go to one place that deals with this. Is that the way it worked, or do they go different places and A doesn't talk to B because this was a different type of complaint?
So Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, so that's one of the things I noticed early on, because I asked the same kind of questions you asked, and what I found and what people have readily shared with me and been very upfront is that the kind of communication you're talking about really happened more by accident than design, which is very problematic. We were very compartmentalized. Lois may or may not know that Donna Shop was looking into a provider and had concerns about licensing. We definitely, there definitely was a real gap between information that our financial folks were uncovering. You know, for me, if a provider, two things, right? If a provider has asked for an advance on their payment for 3 or 4 months in a row, I would want to know why. To me, that's kind of a red flag. Or if a provider has not billed us for 3 or 4 months, that would concern me too. Those things concern me. And it became readily apparent that there really wasn't a process for that kind of information to be shared broadly with all the people who needed to know that. And so I guess I came to the conclusion that if we did not set up a process to do exactly kind of what you're talking about, we weren't going to be able to deal with the issues. And so I think it's been fairly effective in the fact that again, twice a month, all the different parts of the system get together in one room. And Donna says, here's the people we're kind of looking at, and here's some concerns that we have. And then our financial folks weigh in and say, well, we haven't had any financial issues with these people, so you just need to know that. And our investigators said, you know, we've had 4 different complaints this last month, and we're actively investigating them. And then I think even more importantly, as we go through that process, before we leave the room, we as a group agree, and I get to sign off or sanction it, say, so here's what we're going to do about it, and here's what the next steps are, and here's who's responsible to do which part of this. And so I think you hit on something that was really, to me anyway, a real fundamental flaw in our system.
I just received an email. Foster parents, they do sign a discipline and guidance policy, and I just finished reading through it, and it's a good policy. And so with that, the requirements are there. And so when an investigator goes in, it just seems logical for me that they would know what the requirements were for discipline and interview the kids. I know kids can lie, but if there's a pattern, that there needs to be a disciplinary action of some sort for the agency. But I like, you can't withhold food, you can't discipline all children if one misbehaves. I mean, there's, you got a good policy, but these foster care families hopefully read it and read it, and then the investigators then at least have a guideline to follow from. So,
Chair Gelser and Senator Moniz Anderson, what I can't tell you is whether or not our licensed programs provide the DHS document to their foster homes. And that's a piece we've been talking about, how to address that and make sure that we're congruent between the child welfare program and our licensed programs and the expectations of foster home standards.
Well, and I think one of the things that's encouraging is many of the things that you've mentioned and you've been sharing over the last few months are reflected in the concept that we're going to talk about. Before we move on to those, I know that so there were two questions, one for Clyde, and I know they're waiting for you in Ways and Means. Yeah. But the two last things that are on the table are with the federal investigation and potential civil liability out there for kids that were harmed. What should we be thinking about in terms of our financial exposure, of what we may need to be paying back to the federal government, or what types of risks we might be facing from civil litigation related to this situation?
So, Chair Gelser, one of the things I have asked our financial folks to do is to kind of go back and at least initially kind of give me a real high-level view of when you look at the money that was paid to the provider, how much total billings we paid out, and then also what the federal split or what the federal share of that was. I haven't got that yet.
Okay.
You know, with civil litigation, I wouldn't even want to hazard a guess, but it's a risk and it's a potential liability.
Okay. Thank you. And then the other question that we were hoping to talk about today was the kids that were there, many of whom are still in care. I had the opportunity to meet with a couple of them over the winter break, and this question became even more prescient for me after meeting them. And I think Senator Moniz Anderson referenced it after these kids spent about an hour and a half, and you know, I've shared that with Clyde. I think Clyde shared it with Lois, sharing just horrifying stories. The one girl at the end said, "Gosh, you know, these are bad things that happened, but I'm a bad kid, so I probably deserved it." What are we doing to reach out to every single one of these kids that experienced this to, one, apologize and tell them that we failed them, two, let them know that they deserve better, that they are worthy of safety and care, and three, to make sure that they know who to call and what to expect as they continue in the foster care system? Because I'm concerned these kids are now even more vulnerable than they were before, because our system has trained them that that's just the way it is when you're in foster care.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, you and I have had some back and forth in email, Senator Gelser, about this. And what I've done is I've accessed some professional input from a psychologist that works with our kids for and has for a number of years. What I want to do is be accountable to these children for what happened to them in the foster care system. And I want to make sure the committee understands these are not the only children that have had a bad experience in our foster care system. They're not the only children who have been abused, and not all the children at Give Us This Day had a bad experience. And so I want to be very cognizant of their experiences being responsive to what each individual child's experience was, not a blanket assumption around what happened to each child. And one of the things the psychologist said is that because of the differing levels of what occurred to these children that brought them into care and their history of being in care, some of them have had multiple placements, some not as many, some have higher mental health needs than others. They're all unique, these children and youth, and I want to respect that. So my plan today is, and I'm refining it as I go along and get more input, is that I have a list of every child who continues in our system, either in an in-home plan or in a foster care plan, and who their caseworker is. And we're going to reach out to every one of them in a way that's sensitive to who that child is. So we're going to involve their care provider, and if they have a mental health provider, which many of them already do, then the caseworker is going to go through the mental health provider and say, can you tell me how this kid is doing, and can you, in the context of a mental health environment, investigate with this child the impact of that placement or any placement that has had an impact on them and impacted them in a negative way, and work with that child to help mitigate the impact of that. If they don't have a mental health provider, then we're going to work with their foster provider, wherever that is, or residential provider. If they're in a residential, they have a mental health provider, but work with their foster provider around determining how are they doing. Do they need a mental health provider to have this conversation? Can the child, the relationship said that the child can have the conversation with the worker, and a plan be made to address whatever remains of that? That's where I want to start. But again, the larger question is, how do we help children who have negative experiences in foster care? How do we help them mitigate that, given the whole picture of negative experiences they've had that bring them into foster care and they remain there? And what I'd like to do is empanel a group that is multidisciplinary, not just the department, but mental health providers, foster care providers, to say, what is a plan for having a response whenever there's an incident in foster care where a child's abused or it's a negative experience? What can the department do to put in place a system that has a positive response to address that for that child? In terms of an apology to these children, I think you're right. And in my career with this department, I've done that several times. I've done it to children, for children. I've done it for parents. I've done it for numerous people involved in our system when our system fails them, and if I'm in charge of that, then I think they're owed an apology from us, from me, that that occurred. I don't think a blanket apology has as much relevance to people as individual apologies, and I'm struggling with how to get there. I'm hopeful that this exercise in determining at least for a beginning how the children who experienced a Give Us This Day placement are doing will help me understand how to move forward with that. But I agree with you. I think personally and as a representative of the state, if we have a bad outcome, we need to own that to them in a way that's meaningful for them. Currently in our system, there are 243 children who experienced at least one day of placement in foster care. And that's the initial body of work that I want to start on.
And I appreciate all of that. I really appreciate the idea of the panel and the responsiveness. I think the concern about these particular kids and the timeline, I know that not every child maybe experienced something that's defined as abuse, but you know, talking to the girls that I met with, all of the kids in the facility didn't have access to food and tampons, and that's just kind of a daily living expectation. What can I expect from my provider? I know they referenced, you know, one of the girls mentioned she tried to talk to her caseworker, who said, sorry, you're just going to have to deal with it. They raised to the staff the Foster Child Bill of Rights, and they were told they were just words on the wall. What are they going to do about that? So it's, if they are still in care, that I think it's a different level than the how do you help the children process and heal from what's happened to them, but how do you also set them up for further success in the system by letting them know, yes, you're supposed to have access to food, and yes, you shouldn't have to shoplift for your tampons, and no, nobody in your house should be taking pictures of somebody for a prostitution ad. I mean, that, how, it's that piece of information that seems more, that seems urgent and timely, and the other seems like a longer term, how do we help the child heal?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I think you're right. You're absolutely right. And that's why we're starting with the caseworker and saying, look, here's what we learned happened. You need to have this conversation with the mental health provider and figure out the best way to support your child in that. And we're supposed to have the Foster Care Bill of Rights posted in every foster home. And on there is a number. And so a conversation with their providers to ensure that that conversation's happening, that it's posted, that they have access to a telephone and know they can call that number, I think is an important piece of this work as well. So I think that in my mind, I've actually been trying to determine what's the most effective way to get to all these kids in a way where they get a reinforcement for what a good placement is, and we hear about their experience with that provider. So everyone in that facility, the girls you spoke to, would have been experiencing that same thing, which does not mean that everyone who is in a foster home from Give Us the Stay experience. And that's the differentiation right. I was making. Not that kids in that facility weren't impacted, but just two. And honestly, it was one of the most difficult weekends I had when I read what those girls had told you, because it happened recently in a time frame when I felt I had more assurance that it was not happening. And so I really very much, and I've spoken to you, I very much want to be accountable to those girls.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Denbrough.
Thanks. So this is a question for all three of you. You know, as you're working on improvements for the future, what is the role of kids who are in the system now in being part of these panels and providing input and, you know, giving of their obvious firsthand expertise with the issues?
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Denbrough. So hadn't really thought about it very much until the advisory committee started meeting. And then listening to the two members of the advisory committee who had been part of the foster care system, I just came to the realization that if anybody is going to help us fix that, it's these kids. And we have to listen to them. We have to seek them out. We have to have their input, and we have to include them. And you know, it was one of the realizations that came to me in the very first meeting as we started. Senator Gelser was part of those meetings, started listening to the input and the perspective from the foster kids who are on that committee. So they have to be part of the process, and we have to include them.
Chair Gelser and Senator Denbrough, we have for some time been involving either former foster youth or current foster youth in our processes at the department. We have former foster youth representation on our advisory committee. We've actually had foster youth on hiring committees. There's a strong foster youth connections program in Oregon, and we routinely access them to say, can you please provide to us a foster child or a foster care alumni, I believe is how they care to be identified, to bring their voice to the table in this effort. And we will continue to do that.
Thank you all very much. And I'm wondering if, as we kind of end this part of the hearing, if the two of you would be willing to stay and Belissa come up as we go through the bill. People might have questions about practice. And I just wanted to thank both of you, Clyde, too, obviously, and I know you need to go to Ways and Means. I'm so grateful for your leadership and transparency and accountability, the actions that have taken that have been taken over the last few months with the additional providers. And I appreciate both of your willingness to continue coming back to hearings that I know are difficult. I know the subject matter is difficult. I think you now understand why I didn't send that to you while you were on vacation.
I appreciate that. And not for any lack of interest in it, but in retrospect, I really appreciate that consideration.
But I do appreciate that you keep coming, and I want to acknowledge that I don't think it's an easy thing to come, and when you are the administrator of the program, you end up becoming the face of the issue that we discuss, and I think we all understand that you are not the faces of the issue that we are discussing. We're talking about systemic issues. So thank you both very much for continuing to work with us and helping us to build the legislation. So thank you, Clyde. Thank you. Belissa, would you mind coming up? So I'm going to close the informational hearings on all the updates, and then I'm going to open the public hearing on LC 219, which is the Children's Safety and Dignity Bill. And so what I'd like to do, I...
Chair Gelser, do you want Don and I at the table, or you just want us in the room?
I think it would be great if you were there, because I imagine members will have questions about how things work, and a lot in here is a restatement of existing law or practice, or takes something from rule and puts it in here, and you all can describe that better. What I'd like to do is kind of walk through section by section. If I'm wrong, I would like you to tell me. And where there's a problem, I would like you guys to tell me, and then questions as we go through each section. Does that work?
This
and it's
this
in
is
OLIS.
220,
this is 219. This is the long bill. One of the things to keep in mind is that the statute, what was it, like the 1970s, Melissa, hasn't been touched in?
In 1980s.
1980s? So there was a lot of old language. There's a lot of modernization and update of, I think the best one was blanks, like the agency shall provide on blanks that are provided by the agency, and I don't think anyone's sure. So section one defines the scope to include licensed care providers and the foster homes that they oversee. So the universe of this bill are licensed programs that are licensed by Donashop, by Orlo, and that are investigated by OWAPI. It includes the foster homes that Lois was talking about that are supervised by the program. So for instance, in Albertina Kerr that would have families that are providing foster care, or Catholic Community Charities that has the homes and they hire the providers to come in and provide that foster care. But it would not include the foster home down the street that is licensed by the certifier in the local office. And the way that Belisa address that was creating a new phrase, which is these homes that are under the licensed programs in this bill are called family foster homes, and the other homes have retained the language certified foster homes, which is what they've all been called.
And just for the record, I'm Belisa Seidlick, Deputy Legislative Counsel and the drafter of LC 219, and that is a good summary of what I did in order to distinguish those foster homes that are certified by child caring agencies, mm-hmm. as opposed to those that are directly certified by the department under ORS 418, I believe it's 425 to 465. So it can be confusing, but the language is important. We're talking about child caring agencies. And on page two of the bill, that is the title of probably about 40 pages of the bill, child caring agencies. And they are authorized under this bill and under existing law to certify family foster homes, not certified foster homes, but family foster homes, with the approval of the Department of Human Services, which comes in a later section.
And I should just add at this point, you've done such a remarkable job on this in multiple redrafts, and also Kamala Shigar from the Department of Justice has done a really good job of communicating with the agency and looking at it with that DOJ lens, so we can have a good starting place for the conversation. Any questions about Section 1?
No, not Section 1.
Okay. Anybody else? Section 1. Section 2 is more of that same clarification, is that correct?
Well, what I'd like to point out, and Section 1, going back to Section 1, is another aspect of this bill, is that under the definition of child caring agency, we are bringing in to be included in that category of child caring agency shelter care homes that are not foster homes under ORS 418-625, independent resident facilities, which are also covered by statute in current law, private residential boarding schools, and child caring facilities that are defined in ORS 418-950. So we're expanding the definition of child caring agency. And what Section 2 does is it specifies what a child caring agency and the law of child caring agencies does not apply to. So, and that clarifies that it doesn't apply to certified foster homes that are covered under other statutes and that are directly certified by the department.
Senator Olson.
Under Section 1, line 18, where it says, it starts out that child caring agency means, and then it says E, outdoor youth programs. That wouldn't ensnare the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and everybody else, would it?
Chair Gelzer and Senator Olson, that is an area that I'm not real familiar with because I don't think they're typically considered foster homes. They're not within that system, but I would defer to the agency to explain what they are.
Follow up. And this is existing language, right?
Yeah.
This is existing?
Yeah. So that's not a change from current law.
Okay. But my concern is the fact that, you know, it says it means any private school, private agency, or private organization providing outdoor youth programs. That's what the Boy Scouts do.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, the interpretation historically of that existing statute has been that is a particular type of programming that we identify with that is a therapeutic environment in the wilderness. So it's wilderness programs and historically has not included Boy Scouts or any club kind of camping outings. That is how we've interpreted that in the past.
And follow up. And who made that? Is it this is a legal interpretation? And the only reason I'm saying this is I want to make sure that groups that do this, like the Little League, aren't swept up under this. And if something happens, somebody comes in and says, "Hey, I got a law here that says you should have been licensed to have a Little League team." Mm-hmm. That's all it is for me. It's a clarification.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I think that's a very good question and something that I would pursue, and I hope others will pursue. You know, it has been our interpretation, and I think that I'm with you. We would not want to sweep that group into this particular body of oversight.
Senator Dimmer had a fine point. Maybe LC could answer this if he added therapeutic outdoor youth programs. But. I just want to make it clear that because, you know, there are probably lawyers out there, and I apologize for the statement, but they look for anything and everything to be able to file a suit. And this, to me, as a layman, would say that Boy Scouts are covered, have to be licensed.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I think that what you point out is really important, and I think that's exactly what could be clarified in rule. Mm-hmm. That we could make that distinction to ensure that that doesn't happen.
And it's just for my clarification, because like I said, as a layman, I see that and I go, hmm.
So, Senator Olson, if you go on, I thought this was in here, but if you go to page 3, line 20, outdoor youth program means a program that provides in an outdoor living setting services to children who have behavioral problems, mental health problems, or problems with abuse of alcohol or drugs. Outdoor youth program does not include any program, facility, or activity operated by a governmental entity, operated or affiliated with the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, licensed by the Department of Human Services under other authority, or operated by a youth job development organization. So I don't think that the Boy Scouts would be, they aren't primarily providing outdoor, they're not living outdoors.
That's the difference between old technology where you can read ahead and new technology where you can't. All right, thank you. As long as that clarification's in there, I'm fine.
And a clarification on the new language in here. We aren't making programs that are not currently licensed. We're not adding new things that have to be licensed that are not currently licensed.
That is correct, Senator Gelser.
Thank you. All right, Section 2 just clarifies all that, right?
It clarifies what a child caring agency is not.
Okay. So we like to say what things are and what they are not. So Section 3 is primarily a restatement of current law. And this is important because this is the place where we took something out that we had talked to stakeholders about around the corporate status of an organization. So this is to provide the services, you have to have the appropriate license, and you have to be incorporated. But you can have any type of incorporation. We're not saying you have to be a nonprofit. You could be a for-profit. You could be a public benefit corporation. Is there anything else in that section?
No, that would cover it.
All right. So section four is a pretty meaty section, and what this comes down to is the discussion of when the licensing program goes out and they do a licensing review, they have to determine whether or not a program is in substantial compliance. And there have been questions about when does the department have the authority to say someone is or isn't in substantial compliance. And if you do it on a number, that doesn't really give you a chance to weight the things that are more important. So this sets out what those areas are that you have to be fully compliant in order to be found substantially compliant. And those areas are ensuring child and family rights, complying with abuse reporting and investigation requirements, engaging in and applying appropriate and approved behavior management techniques, providing adequate furnishings and personal items, appropriate food services, ensuring safety, and utilizing appropriate medication management. That all comes from existing rule. That's all defined. So there's nothing in this that's creating a new rule. It's just more clearly defining for licensing when something is or isn't in substantial compliance. It goes on to add some, and they aren't required to revoke a license if these things happen. They just have to say in that licensing review, you're deficient in this area. We can't find you in substantial compliance. Within 45 days, you need to fix the problem. And then there's 45 days to fix the problem. Most problems can be fixed pretty quickly. And then it goes on to identify some circumstances in which the department does not have the choice. They must revoke the license. And that's if there's a death of a child as the result of abuse on the part of the agency, there's been sexual or physical abuse or neglect that was known to the agency and the agency didn't make the report about it to the agency and immediately work to make the child safe, that the agency failed to cooperate fully with any local, state, or federal investigation, or that the agency failed to provide reports and financial statements that are required by law. And then it goes on again to grounds. Everything else gives the department, you can take action in these areas. You're not required to take action if there's financial mismanagement. And then it clarifies that it gives the department more work. One of the things that Donna shared was that it's really hard, especially in the capacity of the system, if your only choice is to revoke a license or not revoke a license. So this makes it clear that there's a menu of actions that licensing could take on a license that, you know, kind of ends with revocation, but there could be conditions, there could be a suspension, there could be a site-specific restriction of admissions for a temporary period of time while an issue is addressed. That way you can address a problem in a specific area of a licensed program without losing all of the beds where things are working well within the program. It clarifies existing law that the department cannot charge fees to the agencies for inspections and licenses, and that gets us up through section six. That's a lot, so maybe we should do the second half after the first half.
Just a question, Chair. Has this been vetted with the foster care families or parents? Do they see, have they been given the chance to look at it and just see if they have any suggestions or
this
concerns?
Doesn't impact the foster families in the community. This is just the licensed agencies. This is just the licensed agencies. And nobody's seen this language. We got the language yesterday, so people are seeing the language. We've talked about the concepts since about November, but people have not yet had the opportunity until last night to see the specific
language. I was just wondering if there are situations that where you require revoking a license, that there are extenuating circumstances, like if there was a death but it wasn't due to any fault of the provider. I mean, I'm just concerned about revoking a license when there are extenuating circumstances to what is put in rule in the statute, and I don't know that.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson, Chair, members of the committee. In response to that, the death of the child would have to be as a result of the abuse or neglect on the part of the agency. Mm-hmm. And so there would be a process, I would imagine, to make sure that connection could be made to the death.
Okay.
And I just wanted to point out another aspect of this section is that it specifically allows the department to place conditions on a license that might include placing restrictions on the number of admissions, temporary suspicion or suspension, limitation of operations subject to a letter to revoke, and limitation of operations subject to correction. So I think that wasn't clear before in statute that conditions could be placed on a license, and this bill does that.
And I believe we have the language kind of at the end. It talks about all of those conditions, because I know that restriction of admissions was very important to the department of being clear. So I hope you'll look at that and make sure we have given you what you need.
Chair Gelser, yes. Thank you very much. We will look at that.
All right. Any other questions up through subsection 6 of this one? So if you go on to page 9, this goes into the responsibilities of the department. And this basically makes it very clear that if the department is aware that there's a condition that seriously endangers or places at risk the health, safety, or welfare of a child, that the director has to provide notice and take appropriate and immediate action. It also allows the director to enjoin the operation of a child caring agency, which means to kind of take over the operations. It doesn't require you to do so. There's some you wouldn't want to do, but they could do that if the agency is being operated without a valid license. So again, that would allow the protection of that capacity. You could bring an outside provider in to provide those services, perhaps while the person was getting the license, but it would allow you to take action and not have to move the children. And also allows the agency to enjoin if the agency isn't complying with the plan of correction. And then it goes to this piece that we talked about in a prior one. These next two pieces are where if the Department of Justice or BOLI or the Department of Revenue is investigating a program and identifies problems that impact the safety of children, they need to notify the department. And the department and the director must allow that information to be shared with all of her staff, and they have to look at whether or not that impacts the safety of children.
And that won't, we aren't going to have a problem with confidentiality laws, are we, in this?
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I believe that is still being looked into, but to the extent that this notification and information is provided to the director, I believe that steps will be taken to make sure that that confidentiality and the federal requirements are complied with. I think the important thing is that the information gets conveyed to the director or the director's designee, not necessarily specific confidential information.
Chair Gelser and Senator Mona Sanderson, the next section allows the department to write rules to actually implement that, and I think that that's a place where we could take care of the confidentiality issues.
So that's section 4. Section 5 just adds the next chapters to the statute. I never understand that. Someday we need a lesson. What does that mean when you go and you read your bill in the statute and it says it was never made part of the statute? Anyway, that's a thing for another day. So Section 6 gets to the issue that Lois was talking about, where these organizations are certifying and training their own agencies. And we need to make sure we have the right words here, because we're not trying to create a duplication of effort where everybody's certifying. What we're trying to create here is that when a provider agency initially brings a foster provider on board, the department is kind of giving the green light that they meet the minimum requirements of the state. And to assist the providers with that, the department will be allowed to provide information after the applicant has signed a waiver to the providers about their complete background check, including their child welfare records. And that will resolve the problem of somebody having their license revoked out in the community, and then they go to apply with a provider who doesn't have access to that information. So we will, this would close that loophole.
Chair Gelser, can I just ask a question for clarification? Or maybe it's for you, Lisa. Would your interpretation of this be that the department would not have to duly certify, but would have to certify that they meet the minimum requirements, the latter?
The latter.
Okay, thank you.
The latter. And I think that was in response to the big meeting we had where we're kind of talking about the fiscal, and that's just a lot of, and that'd be a lot of duplication for those poor families too, to have all these people out there talking to them.
Appreciate that.
And then it also clarifies if you're applying and you're not certified, the department and agency have to tell you why. Questions on Section 6 or anything that's been missed on Section 6? No. Section 7, this is important. Okay, so we heard that there are currently only 3 staff in the licensing program to administer. How many programs do you?
Around 200 licensed entities under KIDS.
It's a lot of entities.
Yeah.
And the statement here is not to suggest that 5 is enough. It's to suggest that we're going to increase by 2, and that's a minimum, which means the legislature could do more, the agency could do more, but this is going to require more work, and we want to add that piece in there that if we're asking the department to do a good job with licensing, they need to be staffed to be able to carry out the activities. But it's a minimum, not a maximum.
So I always hate putting numbers in because I would like to hear from the agency the exact caseloads, how many investigations they have to do in a year. I mean, coming down to that level rather than saying 5, I mean, 5 may not even be close. I don't have a sense as to what would be an adequate number to do adequate investigations. Are the investigations of each facility once a year? Is it once every 5 years?
Chair Gelser, Senator Moniz Anderson, the current rule has the licensing coordinators or surveyors going in once every 2 years. This bill would double that in terms of annual checks, which I think is a very reasonable, minimal thing to do.
Yes.
But in addition to that, there's a, with the increase in our authority to do conditions and place more restrictions on a provider, that will cause a whole body of work around due process and hearings rights and corrective action in a more formal fashion. Again, I think that's a really good thing, but it's an additional workload that these 3 people currently would have to absorb.
So there are, you said 200?
There are approximately 200.
And so if you have 5, that means 40, 40, each person gets 40 facilities.
Yes.
And there are 50, so they would need to be visiting approximately 1 facility a week.
Yes.
I mean, there are 52 weeks
yes.
in a year, but
yes.
vacation, la, 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 so that they would have to, okay.
Yes.
That's reasonable.
And then Senator Moniz Anderson, not to beat it to death, but in addition to that, you know, that's when things are good and there are no corrective actions, and that is not.
Which then you have to go back.
Yes,
and then
many
you have
times.
To, yeah.
And the paper process. These 3 people do the full spectrum of the assurance of safety in these facilities. So, you know, the survey is actually the smallest piece of their work, I would say, the actual on-site visit.
Well, it'd be nice to know. I mean, I think they should be investigated once a year. I mean, that's just gut feeling when we're dealing with lives of children. But it'll be nice to monitor that to see if the facilities really can have 1 visit a week with corrective action if necessary.
And for complete transparency, the reason the number is 5 is that's in talking with the budget folks. That's what we that's what we know we can get from Ways and Means in this process is that 2 additional FTE down there.
Madam Chair. Okay, actually, that was my question, Madam Chair. So the expectation is that the agency won't be able to absorb this cost. We'll have to do that. This bill will have to go through the Ways and Means process.
Correct. And this issue of this 2 additional FTE has been kind of discussed and approved with leadership in both chambers and in the middle.
Madam Chair. Ma'am, what's their time allocation now? Are they behind on everything they're doing, or are they even with it, or are they ahead of it, or?
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, they are up to date on their visits every 2 years, but I don't think there's any one of them that would feel that they're up to date on their work, because, you know, there are so many things that can be happening that we don't know about and that we aren't able to check on, and actions that we wish we could take to both help the providers in terms of technical assistance, but also to, you know, provide that oversight and accountability piece. So, you know, because our requirement is to visit once every 2 years, that becomes our priority, that becomes our metric. But the actual assurance of safety, there's a whole lot that we are not doing that we could be doing.
Do you only do child foster care? Do you do senior foster care also?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Senator Olson, as the Director of the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, I have 5 different program areas. So my office oversees the senior, the aging and people with disabilities licensing, the DD licensing, the children's licensing, which has many different types of licenses and many different responsibilities.
And follow up, and these two will be put into all 5 of those categories? They'll be working in all 5 or just in child care?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, this would be a designated only for the children's care licensing unit. Under my office, the overall office has, I think, 5,000 licensed entities. So there are a lot of providers under this office.
How many people do licensing total in your facility?
My office is about 140 staff, and that includes support staff and management and different types of surveyors. Some program areas are federally funded and have a more prescriptive mandate for oversight, and they are more heavily staffed accordingly because we're under CMS direction and funding. So there is a broad disparity between the number of staff that are attributed to one program over another. The Children's Care Licensing Unit is has the smallest staff, and in all fairness, if you look at just quantity of programs, probably the smallest number of programs, notwithstanding the size of the individual licensed entities.
Thank you.
Section 8 and 9, there's nothing substantive in those. Is that correct?
No changes.
Yeah. All right. Section.
Let's get them out. Save a few pages.
Section 10 also modernizes existing language. Goes to what Donna was just talking about. The statute right now requires unannounced, unscheduled, unexpected visits beyond the licensing period. This clarifies that should happen at least once a year. So that's where that additional workload comes from. And it clarifies that at those unannounced visits, that needs to include something that's come up in these discussions, an inspection of the common areas, the kids' personal living areas, bathrooms, kitchens, kind of really getting a picture of what's going on. A new requirement, this is the one clear, very new requirement for the providers. It would require CPA audited financial statements for organizations with revenues over $1 million a year, and financial statements that are reviewed by a CPA, so not audited, but reviewed by a CPA for smaller organizations. And then when there's a problem, this came from Senator Olson, you know, if there's flags or concerns, the department can order a forensic audit, and that would be done at the expense of the department. Clarifies that these are public records and clarifies, and this came up in the situation we've been talking about, that failure to allow an inspection or department personnel to enter a facility would be grounds for revocation of a license.
Chair Gelser, not referencing this section, but the prior question, I have a need to clarify.
Yeah.
I misspoke on the number of staff in my office. It's actually the number of FTEs, I believe, is 111. So I misspoke and exaggerated the number there a bit. So I wanted to clear that up for
Thank
the record.
You.
But moving on to this, this is an excellent section that I'm excited for us to implement.
Is there anything missing in that description? Any questions about that section? Okay, section 11 also modernizes the existing statute. It clarifies the range of actions that can be taken on a license. So it kind of restates that language that we already talked about in section 4. I'm not at the right spot. It requires the department to investigate concerns that come to the attention of the agency, which actually is already existing statute. This is some of that prior language, and requires the legislature to requires a report to the legislature when there's a persistent failure to comply with licensing standards. That also is existing law. Requires any DHS employee with concerns about a program to report those concerns, whether they are abuse concerns or licensing concerns. And that's one of the things that came up. You know, lack of food, for instance, is not in the abuse definition, but that would be a licensing standard or part of a contract. And they would need to provide that information so it doesn't get lost because it gets to the hotline and the hotline can't deal with that. It makes the failure to report those concerns official misconduct, which is a crime, and the failure of an administrator to allow investigation and take appropriate action would also be defined as official misconduct, which is an existing crime. It just clarifies what that is.
So somebody's going to jail then, right?
It's a misdemeanor. But it's important. It's a misdemeanor, but it's important for the culture and that conversation that these issues are. That's not just not doing your job. That's a criminal act. Section 12 is.
Madam
yeah.
Chair, could you just clarify? So, as you envision it, how does law enforcement get involved in this? So there's a requirement that law enforcement be notified by someone. You know, I saw some permissive language in there that they may contact law enforcement.
So because this section covers not just abuse, there's concerns that wouldn't fit within an abuse definition, and we don't want to make every problem an abuse finding. We don't want to create extra work for everybody by notifying law enforcement where there isn't a crime or there isn't already a duty to cross-report because it's an allegation of abuse. So, for instance, if the concern was that the tampon thing, the concern was that the kids don't have access to feminine hygiene supplies, that's not really a law enforcement action. That's an action for Donna's shop and Lois's shop to address. So it's the may notify as necessary to coordinate and assist in the investigation and enforcement. It's when it's necessary, and they'll define that out by rule. They are required if there's a crime, if they're aware of a crime, that crime, there's a requirement to report that to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm just wondering, you know, you're talking about sanctions and criminal sanctions for lack of doing one's duty or whatever it was that you called it. And so how would law enforcement be notified? I mean, who would blow the whistle there as you envision it?
So in these cases, it could be a whistleblower within the agency. My understanding is this type of official misconduct would be pursued by the Attorney General. It's not like a local investigation. Right now, the statute on official misconduct says something along the lines of, I don't know if I can find this. Sorry. Yeah, I'm missing it. The current statute basically says a public official commits the crime of official misconduct. A public servant commits the crime of official misconduct in the second degree if the person knowingly violates any statute relating to the office of the person. official misconduct in the second degree is a Class C misdemeanor. So that already is existing statute. What we've learned from the Department of Justice is you need to very clearly articulate what those duties are in the statute for DOJ to be able to trigger that. So by identifying these things that are very clear, high-level duties of, it creates that distinction between my paperwork was late, which is not official misconduct, that's workload management, and my kid on my caseload told me that she has no food and tampons, and I don't ever tell anybody that's official misconduct. Or I'm the director of an agency, and people tell me that kids are in a facility that doesn't have a license, and I don't pull the kids out, that would perhaps land in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to make sure we get this right.
So 12, 13, 14, 15 are all non-substantive, correct? 16 is, again, clarifying that initial sign-off, and we'll have to work to make sure we have the language exactly right on those family foster homes. Section 17, non-substantive, yeah. 18, it's accommodating that new description of family foster home. 19, non-substantive. 20, it modernizes the existing statute, which isn't substantive, but it clarifies that CASA's attorneys, DHS employees, and parents or legal guardians must have access to the kids they're serving, and they can't be denied that access. That's currently in rule. This makes it much more explicit in the statute. Section 21 clarifies that visits with siblings can't be prohibited as a disciplinary matter. The statute right now says that about parents, but we know that siblings are important as well. 22 and 23 aren't substantive, is that correct, Lisa? Section 24 restates that fees can't be charged for licenses or inspections of private residential boarding schools, and it again clarifies that authority of the department to take action on the licenses. Section 25 is non-substantive. Section 26, again, just has that updating of the language. The substantive piece in here is that it requires that payment to licensed facilities be completed through electronic funds transfer instead of by a check. And I'm still confused about Section 27.
No changes, right?
Oh,
there is.
Senator Gelser, Chair Gelser, and members of the committee, Section 27, that begins the series that deals with the certified foster homes, not the family foster homes. So, and this just clarifies the definition of a certified foster home as not including the family foster home under the child care, that it has been certified by a child caring agency.
Okay. I always get nervous when I just see like one statute referenced and it was like 1 in the morning last night, and so my little note to myself just says, Belissa, question mark. So 28, 29, 30, nothing substantive? Is that right?
Yes, Chair Gelser, that is correct. Section 29 deals with child caring facilities, which are now a child caring agency under the new definition.
Section 31 updates the civil penalty section with references to comply with the new language. It adds it adds civil penalties around operating without an appropriate license or certificate, falsifying records, accepting a child if the provider knows. So again, the provider has to know that the child's needs exceed the license, and the provider would have to know that that placement would put the child's health, safety, or welfare at risk. It allows the department to require an immediate remedy if there is health, safety, or welfare of a child. It updates the timeline. So the statute has always prescribed a period of time in which a deficiency has to be corrected. The statute currently says 30 days, but current rule says 45 days. So we'll update the statute to comply with the rule, and it requires rulemaking for objective criteria for the civil penalties. Questions? Did I miss anything? No. Okay, 32 and 33, 34, 35, nothing substantive. Section 36 is this section that kind of standardizes the definition of abuse across all licensed agencies. This is the abuse definition that's used for children with developmental disabilities in licensed care settings, for seniors, for adults with developmental disabilities, mental illness. So this, the best way to think about this is this then applies, this definition applies to programs licensed by Donishop and investigated by AWAPI. And they are organizations, they are different from my home. If somebody made an allegation about my care of my children, this does not impact that. Or if I was a family or certified foster home provider, this also does not provide this. This is more appropriate when there are staff, shift staff, other people that are coming in. I did notice that there is something that needs to be clarified in here, and it's on page 38, lines 10 and 11, and it has to do with sexual contact. It's it includes as abuse any sexual contact between an employee of the child caring agency, a caretaker, or other person and a child in care, and we want to make sure that we are not substantiating abuse if teenagers are having consensual sex with other teenagers. And then this also adds the very important piece, and you can see that actually in that AWAPI chronology around investigations they couldn't complete. It adds authority for 18 to 20 year olds that are committed to the care of the department. Right now the department doesn't have the authority to investigate abuse in those cases.
Chair Gelser, it was brought to my attention, and this may be something we can fix rather quickly, that child welfare doesn't have the authority to take reports on 18 to 20 year olds because we only have authority to take reports on children. So that's a piece we might have to somehow figure out tweaking, where we can take reports on 18 to 20 year olds.
It's in there. It's in there. Later, okay. It's in there.
In another section. Thank you.
But that was that was a really important one. And the other is making sure that when that call comes into the hotline around a licensed facility, and already some that should be forwarded to AWAPI or to licensing, and that comes up later. If somebody calls in the lack of food or the tampons to the hotline, that's not going to be an abuse complaint, but that really does need to get to licensing or to you so that that can be addressed for the child. Mm-hmm. Questions about that one? 36. And I would just mention one other, because there's a question that a number of people have asked, that there's a definition around wrongful taking of items that belong to a person. So wrongfully taking the assets, funds, or property belonging to or intended for the use of a child in care, or alarming a child by conveying a threat to wrongfully take or appropriate monies or property. The emphasis is on wrongfully. It's not, you can't use your iPhone tonight because you didn't do your homework, so you're kind of on restriction from your iPhone. It's, you didn't clean the bathroom, so I am taking possession of your iPhone forever and taking it home to give it to my other child. It's this wrongful appropriation of, you are taking ownership, permanent ownership away of that child's private property. Section 37, again, is this requiring action to be taken when DHS becomes aware of suspicion of abuse in care. This has all of these pieces to ensure that the appropriate people are notified, that licensing is notified when that comes up, that staff in a licensed agency have to immediately report suspected abuse to DHS. Clarifies that report has to be to DHS, not to administrators within that licensed care program, and the child care agency has to provide that to them. It clarifies that interfering with an investigation or the falsification of records or denying accesses to witnesses is grounds for a license revocation. Again, clarifies that civil and criminal immunity for good faith reporting that already exists in the mandatory abuse statute. And the important last bullet is that it allows the disclosure of otherwise confidential information when making a report. So if there's an AWAPI investigator that is really concerned that there's a problem that's going unaddressed, they would be able to go and talk to the director or talk to the governor's office or talk to the Department of Justice and say, I've gone through all of these avenues, and they could disclose that confidential information from their abuse investigation, and that would have to stay confident within that report. Section 38 is... And this was a really interesting thing that DOJ raised, and a couple of people have raised. If child welfare comes to your house, Senator Montes Anderson, and investigates an allegation of abuse with your child, the allegation will be founded if there is reasonable cause to believe after that investigation that abuse has occurred. If your child is then taken and put in a certified foster home and there's an allegation of abuse and DHS comes to investigate, they will take action and it will be founded or substantiated if there's reasonable cause to believe that abuse has occurred. If that child then goes into a licensed care facility for some reason that got changed and it's a higher level, it's a preponderance of the evidence. So this would keep all kid investigations the same. It would all be that reasonable cause to believe, so that parents don't have their kids removed for a lower standard than kids in the care of the state are held to. This also requires notification of the child's parents, attorney, CASA, and caseworker when a child is the subject of an abuse investigation. This next one was suggested by the governor. It clarifies that the child in care has the right to have their attorney or parent present when interviewed by an investigator. And that includes when the child is the alleged victim of abuse, but also if the child is an alleged perpetrator. AWAPI might be investigating a neglect on the part of the provider, but we want to make sure that child has appropriate counseling about what they're sharing with an investigator. The reports, documents, and records around a substantiated allegation of abuse, and we've talked a lot about this, Clyde talked about this, access to records. If an abuse is substantiated, that substantiated report would be redacted, all identifying information removed, but that redacted report within a licensed facility would be a public record that could be, and that's substantiated. I misspoke when we met before. That's a substantiated allegation. And then when a report is substantiated, it must be offered to the director of DHS, the licensing administrators, and child welfare administrators, and also the parents, attorneys, CASAs, and caseworkers of all children residing in that location where there's been a substantiated abuse would be provided non-identifying information that there had been an issue in the facility.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that an allegation of abuse, the child could have a lawyer present.
Mm-hmm.
The person that is alleged to have committed the abuse, are they allowed to have a lawyer present?
I believe they can have a lawyer present. We would need the AWAPI folks. What they can't have, the agency can't require that their supervisor be present when they're interviewed by AWAPI.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I believe that Chair Gelser has accurately stated that you can have an attorney present when you're questioned.
Okay.
You can,
okay.
Yes. But you can't have, say, your direct supervisor or someone who might be considered influencing what you're disclosing. But you can have counsel. Chair Gelser, can I just ask a question about, I have to admit I did read this quickly last night, but I'm wondering how this particular section 4 of, what are we on? Well, page 41, lines 17 through 23, how that interfaces with ORS 419B035, which is the confidentiality statute for child abuse reports, which are public records but are exempt from the public records release, except if certain conditions are met, how that interfaces and if it is appropriate here, if it should be over in 419B.
So we're working on that. Okay. We're working on that question. The idea is, because we've created this new definition, this is all this child in care, which is something that happens in a licensed facility. The federal law about that exemption is talking about children in their family home. So this would be aligned with what we're doing related to the other. So right now, if you're looking at a child with a developmental disability, for instance, you can access those records. An adult with a developmental disability, a senior, it would just align that across AWAPI.
Chair Gelser, I just want to make sure that we have alignment with that 419B, because that relates to all child abuse reports, regardless of the setting.
Okay.
So, and that's maybe for you, Lisa. Thank you.
Very good. The Then section 39, I believe this is the issue that gets at Lois's other question. It adds the 18 to 21-year-olds to mandatory reporting when the child is a child in care and the hotline. Section 40, right now, for some reason, the charitable activities oversight law has a special exemption that does not allow the Department of Justice to oversee charities that offer child caring programs. So this just pulls that out and has them treated like all other nonprofits. And the rest is the effective dates and the rest of the conforming amendments. The effective date of the substantial compliance pieces, there's an emergency clause on the entire bill. I would argue that we have an emergency, Senator Olson, as it relates to a number of these issues. But the changes as it relates to what's considered substantial compliance would be pushed out to July 1st. And that gives a number of months if agencies know they have pieces that they wouldn't have been concerned about before. That gives them several months before that licensing review even takes place. And then if they still aren't in compliance, they would still have that 45 days. So that's not going to lead to a bunch of people losing licenses, but we don't want to disadvantage those whose licensing survey is scheduled for March by changing that. Were there things in here that were missed, Melissa, that were important to point out?
Chair Gelzer, I believe that you caught the important points of this bill in an exceptional way. Thank you.
Thank you for writing that. It in an exceptional way.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank you for all your hard work on this. This is very, very thorough. I wonder if it would be useful at some point if we could put together a schematic of what exactly is new in this. You know, I mean, comparing existing statute, that which is in statute and also in rule, you know, existing agency policy, and then what's brand new. Just so that we could see that, you know, how exactly this is going to help us move the needle with new policies.
And I think that's important. I think one of the things, if you saw that schematic, a lot of what's in here is a restatement of what exists in law and statute and makes it a lot more clear. I think what we heard from licensing and DOJ is that it would be very helpful in that licensing process to just have a great degree of clarity about what the authority is. And I think the other thing I really want to emphasize, the piece about the audits, the financial statements, is new. That is a new requirement that does not currently exist. Beyond that, we are not adding new regulations. We're talking about the process by which existing regulations are enforced, and it primarily points back to rules. So even in that section where we're talking about substantial compliance, it speaks about those issues in broad areas. The department will still be able to adjust those issues within rule if they need to, as long as they're meeting those broader kind of topics like child safety, medication, mm-hmm. child abuse reporting. But we'll work to get that before February 1st. Right. I'm wondering, one of the things that I'm wondering after our discussion this morning, when we talk about informing all of the appropriate folks after a substantiated allegation, I heard you, Lois, saying that you want to know when that complaint has been made in general so that you can follow that pattern. Is that something that can be addressed internally, or is that something that should be in the statute, that flow of information at the complaint level as opposed to the substantiation level?
Chair Gelser, we have adjusted it internally, and it's I think that what I would want is that it not be in statute, but it be in rule around how OWAPI manages the notifications. And I think that we can take care of it that way. But it has been adjusted, and I now have a regular flow coming into my email when there's an allegation of or a screening opened to determine if we have abuse in a licensed facility.
And I wanted to check, were there any things that you all have highlighted in your discussions in the last few months that you needed or you raised that we missed that is not in here?
Chair Gelser, speaking for myself, I similarly read this at about 1 o'clock, and so I can't respond to that question yet, but it certainly, I know we're going to have a meeting tomorrow, actually, okay, to go through this in more detail and really talk about that. So thank you for that offer.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, I would just concur with what Lois said.
Okay.
I have looked at it, and I'm appreciative of the authorities that we will have clarified by this rule, and we'll take another look and see if there's anything that needs to be added.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other questions before we move on to the public testimony for these folks? And Melissa, will you stick around in case there's questions, or do you need to go? I know you've got bills to draft and problems to solve.
If I could just contact my office real quickly. I did have a meeting at 10, but
oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'll let them know that I need to be here.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And do you mind sticking around in case there's questions? I think we're almost done. All right, we have Janet Ahrens. And Doug. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Wow, what a morning. I am Janet Ahrens, Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We have to start out by thanking Senator Gelser. It's incredible work, and I am happy to hear that all of your colleagues who are really digging in right now are agreeing with that. You're looking for solutions, which is very, very positive. And you've been engaging the Alliance, which is, of course, we think very, very positive. So we're appreciative of that opportunity and information. So this is a very dense and complex bill, but it also creates many opportunities, and we're looking forward to working on those. There's some material coming around, and I'm just working off of the one page that talks about that starts with our commitment to safety. And when we really, really believe, and you know, actually you don't even have to believe this because it's pretty obvious and straightforward, that safety is the first step to well-being and to recovery. And that's why we appreciate the focus on safety as the core of what we want to achieve out of all of this. So, and for that reason, we've been very supportive of Senator Gelser's work on making this a paramount priority and making that very, very clear. Towards that end, we also we've had much conversation about this, and Chair Olson, I don't want to speak for you, but to speak for the Alliance, we believe that there's a very, very big core moral issue around children who are in the custody of DHS and out of home care, and that speaks specifically to making sure that every child in DHS custody in and out of home care has a right to expect a common standard of safety and security in that care. And so we really believe that the family foster care system must be included underneath this bill and the standards and the changes that we're making and emphasizing. It's very important to us. I just want to make that really clear. The capacity for kids, I really appreciate the comments about capacity and what's happening. That the challenge, capacity equals safety, and that's a very important statement also, because if they're not coming into care, what is happening to them? And certainly without care and without supervision, the circumstances in their homes and their lives are probably not improving. In fact, they're probably getting worse. So. But it's also important to know that capacity is currently shrinking in Oregon. And you mentioned the foster care at Albertina Kerr. They just turned their foster care contracts back. There are 12 programs in the last several months who have returned contracts to the state for children because they're not sustainable. They're losing too much money. There's tremendous risk in managing the kids and making sure they're complying with rules and regulations that currently exist. So we need to make sure we have a balance on those rules and regulations that we're not shifting a focus on the outcomes for the kids over to achieving outcomes with rule compliance. So there will be several steps that we'll need to take as we move through the rules and the implementation or build rules. And there will be lots of hydraulics that we can't see. And it's important to understand the culture conversation that DHS was having, very important. The Children First, the Bill of Rights for foster kids that we also supported is an example that rules are, it's like a coloring book. So the rules are the framework. And then the culture is how you color that in. And one of the examples of how you color in rules for children's rights and safety would be the Bill of Rights. But it's also going to have to do with how the providers move forward and how that department moves forward in the rule development and the kinds of things that we do to make to ensure that we can achieve these new standards. One of the concepts we have, the second page attached is a list of concepts that we have that we think need to be included in considerations going forward. And the top one that we have on here is establishing a center for continuous improvement, and that would be a provider-driven place where technical assistance, peer reviews, research on promising evidence-based practices and strategies would be available any provider anytime, whether they're under review or whether they simply want to continue to move forward, have a place to go. It might be that the center would be used as a referral and a corrective action. You need to go here and work on these things. One of the questions, Clyde invited me to come and meet with the folks at DHS, and one of the questions was, what do you do when you get to that bar, when that provider's at that place where they can't meet the standards and it's really clear? And I believe I said, that's not the right question. The question is, how do you keep them from ever getting there? And so we have to build in, and that culture changes for providers as well, the opportunities to be able to get preemptive work and a culture of continuing improvement. So that would be one of the pieces that we want to make sure gets considered in this. Putting it in, I see you glancing over there. I'm in a hurry. So I'll just leave that there. So investing in safety and outcomes is really important. We can't just fund the regulation. We have to fund the implementation. And I think there was some question about if these are rules and regulations that DHS is going to be investing a lot of time and FTE to build, to put out into the community, that, you know, what if the focus is there, then how does that trickle down to the provider? So, for example, you're talking about a significantly increased number of investigations and doubling the number of annual licensing reviews. Every time an investigation happens, if we have one staff person under investigation and it takes the 45 days, that line staff or entry-level person, it's about $6,000 in the cost to the provider to pay the person who's off, to pay for overtime, for other people to come in and fill those shifts. And that's not counting all the other time that they spend working with investigators, meetings, changing policies and whatnot. And if you're talking about a supervisor or manager, it bumps up to $18,000. We have more fiscal impact statements that we'd previously submitted on various rules that we can go back to and pull more data out of. But there's no question a trickle-down cost and impact on the providers that we have to make sure that they're getting there. And thank you for your comment about rates also. And I didn't know if you knew that for the last 18 months, the state agencies with providers and with youth and with advocacy organizations have been meeting to look at access. And these are the same kinds of programs that you're talking about in the scope of the bill, to talk about access. How do people get into the services that they need at the right level and the right time? What are the programs need to have in them? Are we doing the right things? And how are you going to resource? What's the methodology for resourcing and what should that resourcing look like. And they're just wrapping up their work, but it looks like the target that they've identified for a rate gap is around 30%. And that's without anything new. That's just moving forward with the pieces that people are familiar with. So the long and the short of it is we have several other ideas, and we're vastly supportive. We're 110% supportive of where you're going. We have some comments that we'll make on the bill as we have a chance to get through it. I decided to go to bed. So we'll be getting back to you shortly with more comments.
Great. Thanks. And again, the comments, the sooner the
Oh yeah. The
sooner the better. We're off to the races. And I wanted to clarify, it's not increasing to an annual licensure. That increase is that those irregular, unannounced, somebody just shows up. That has to happen at least once a year. So that shouldn't
Great.
Be causing you to prepare or
No, or that's be, right. Just, that would be the point.
So, Madam Chair,
yeah.
I'm really interested and this can be not here, but mm-hmm. what is involved in it? Investigation that it would cost $6,000 for a facility.
That's just the staffing time. If you have to pay somebody to be offsite on administrative leave for 45 days because they cannot
off-site?
Have they can't
so the
well they cannot they don't necessarily have to be offsite, but they it depends on the facility, what their policy is, how big the facility is, if there are other duties or not, but they're still not doing the job that they're salaried to do. So it's not uncommon for providers to move people during the well, they're required to have no contact with the kids in the investigation, and so if they have to send them home, then they have to pay that person while they're home, or they often do, and they also have to pay for overtime for other staff. You can't hire. One of the challenges of the 45-day rule on correction act, corrective actions, is that there are, for example, around hiring staff, to go through the existing rules and regulations for hiring, criminal background checks, all the things that you have to do, the number of people who are involved in the pieces for making those hiring, doing the training. They are not allowed to have contacts with kids until they've achieved certain training expectations and requirements. You can't do it in 45 days. So we're hoping that we're going to have a look at that, so we make sure that we're not having rules to prohibit people from meeting other rules with standards.
And just following up, I mean, the fact that we are having providers dropping out of the system because mm-hmm. it's just, you know, not economical. I don't want to have a system that's going to be burdensome. I want a system that's actually going to be attractive for people to want to provide care. So
thank you. Yes.
Thank you for your comment.
And I think that goes back to the issue of what our responsibility is as the legislature. I think the standards that we've set out are minimal standards, and I don't think we want to compromise on those standards in terms of kids being safe. But we have to recognize when we take custody of a child and we're caring for a child and we're placing them with a program and saying, we want you to care for this child, we want you to provide therapy for this child, we want you to deliver these outcomes for this child, we have to actually resource that so it can happen. And when we don't, that's why we lose people when it doesn't pencil out.
Yeah. Madam Chair, just to clarify, I mean, there are investigations and investigations, right? I mean, what we were talking about earlier was a kind of a regular annual review that might not be spurred by any complaints, et cetera. Those that are spurred by complaints, then you might have to have a higher standard of keeping the affected employees away from the site. But you wouldn't have to do that during the regular, a kind of annual review, would you?
Senator Gelser and Senator Dembrow, thank you for the question. Yes. Well, yes, we would. There are staffing costs for the reviews.
Sure.
Because there's, you know, as you can imagine, it's pretty straightforward. And I just wanted to comment on the cost a little bit. I had a phone call yesterday afternoon from one of our members who's a very, very well-known, very well-respected organization who is a leader in innovation in foster care and high standards, and they are furloughing employees, and they're currently rotating payment to their vendors in order to be able to every 60 days get a little something until they can figure out what they're going to do. And they just turned back four programs to the state, four contracts.
And so I think we're going to continue the funding discussion, and some of these other pieces are going to pop up in the next bill that we're going to preview in a second. Doug?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just really want to echo that, and I cannot echo and repeat enough how much of a crisis this system could be in and is leading into.
Oh, Doug, you have to introduce yourself.
Oh, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Alliance for Children's Program. Sorry about that. I should know better. The 12 programs that Janet mentioned include three specific programs for girls and three culturally specific programs. And so for DHS to be able to provide capacity to put kids in the right place, there have to be qualified programs. Programs in the Alliance, you know, have child safety as number one, and if those programs are dropping out of the system, that indicates that we've got a very significant and serious problem. So we will work with you and work with the Ways and Means Committee and work with the DHS to make sure that the program actually supports the children by ensuring that we have capacity in qualified places. Otherwise, the kids will have no place to go but non-qualified areas, and we certainly do not want that to happen.
Thank you very,
thank
very
you.
Much.
Appreciate this.
All right. Was there anybody else that wanted to speak on 219 today? And we will have, the way that it will work in our short session, we meet on Monday, February 1st. We can't post a public hearing on Monday, February 1st, but I will post this bill as an information hearing, and we will take testimony. So it'll be open to public testimony because we only have four meetings.
Are we violating the rules?
No. There's no rule. But it's just that, and then there will be a public hearing and a work session on the Wednesday. All right, so I will close the public hearing on LC 219, and briefly open a public hearing on LC 220. I'm just going to speed through this one really quickly. This talks about creating a work group of the providers and the department to work on developing what an appropriate licensing and fee structure. The bill that we have in there, I'm requesting amendments, sorry, Melissa, that includes some of the elements that that Janet has just provided to us. We're so close to February that describing and defining what this technical assistance program would look like, I don't know that we can get there in the next 2 weeks, but it would in add to the charge of that group a number of these issues to look at and make recommendations for us in 2017. And along with that, just really keeping this issue on the front burner. These are, you know, this big bill, I think, will make some improvements. The worst thing that could happen is that we would do that and all walk away and say, okay, we've taken care of our kids, our foster care, our kids in substitute care issue. We've got issues across the board for really high need kids that are really deserving of our attention and our resources moving forward. So that's LC 220. Does anybody want to talk about LC 220? Great. Okay. Closing public hearing on LC 220, opening the public hearing on shifting gears briefly, and we'll do this briefly because I know you testified yesterday in healthcare, but opening a public hearing on LC 134, and we have Marcus Watt and Adam Kircher come on up, and we'll let you briefly describe the bill and where we're at. And I think the bill will actually end up in Senator Mona Sanderson's committee. Thank you. Thank you so much. And we're set. Thank you. So anybody that's here for DHS, you're finally off the hook. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for allowing us to share some of your very valuable time today. For the record, my name is Marcus Watt. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I'd like to state that the Oregon Board of Pharmacy fully supports the concept of LC 134, which is to further expand access to safe and effective previously dispensed prescription drugs to our low-income and indigent populations. When we saw LC 134, we had some suggestions that we felt would improve the bill, and we reached out to Senator Gelser's office, and I'd like to thank you for facilitating a meeting. Her staff facilitated a conference call Tuesday afternoon where we were able to share our suggestions with her staff and the proponents of the bill. As a result of that phone call, we were able to come to agreement and consensus on what we felt could improve this while still maintaining safety in the drug supply chain. We just crafted our suggestions to that bill, and they were transmitted to the interested parties about a half hour ago. So if there's any concerns, I'm sure we'll have ongoing conversation, but for right now, I think that we're in a very good place for this to go forward.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, thanks so much. My name is Adam Kircher. I'm co-founder and director of Serum. Serum's a nonprofit, 501c3, founded at Stanford University, and our mission is to help people get the medications that they would otherwise not be able to afford. Unfortunately, one in four Americans cannot afford the prescription medications that they're supposed to be taking. We really very much appreciate working with the board on this. We think we're in a very good spot and very aligned on our aims. And so once we have a chance to review those suggestions, I think we're ready to move forward as well.
And can you just briefly describe what it's doing? Because some people don't know.
Absolutely. We have started a pharmacy in Oregon that's a charitable pharmacy that's helping other clinics get medication. So these clinics like Central City Concern, Reinhardt Clinic serve vulnerable people such as like homeless people. Right now, the medications that we send to those clinics need to be patient specific. And so what will happen is like a patient will go into Reinhardt, ask for medication. Reinhardt will then talk to us. We'll go fill that medication, and that person has to come back a week later. Unfortunately, that puts the person, especially a homeless person, telling them to come back, you know, on Sunday at 4 p.m. It doesn't always work, and so sometimes we're skipping helping the people, and we haven't gotten access. So by allowing us to repackage that medicine and then send it in a non-patient-specific manner, we can give that to the clinic who needs it, and then that clinic is then able to give it to the patient right when they come in, not a week later.
Thank you. Any questions?
I do have a question. Thank you. This is a great potential program. Thank you for bringing it to us. The process, you know, where something is donated and then it's repackaged by another charitable organization, I wonder if you could explain that a little bit and how the charitable organization is presumably endorsed by the Board of Pharmacy, or how is this actually going to work?
Well, you ask hard questions. No. The issue of repackaging, I believe, revolves around the source of the donated drugs. The majority of the drugs currently, if I understand correctly, is from long-term care pharmacies where they're typically dispensed to the patient or the home in a 30-day bubble card. When those are returned and the patient is no longer on the medication, they're donated to the charitable pharmacy who, when they receive an order now, they punch out individual tablets into the container they're going to ship it to, put a patient's label on it, and then send it out. The repackaging component would allow them to assemble packages with a quantity of medication in it prior to receiving a prescription and be able to send it to another pharmacy where it could be on the shelf to be utilized when the patient arrives to pick it up. And that's where some of our suggestions came from. We're kind of bumping up against some of the FDA rules and regulations on repackaging and manufacturing and wholesaling, and we want to make sure that we are not opening up ourselves or them to any federal scrutiny for this. So that's where our concerns came from, and that's kind of how I'm working unless I...
Oh, that's right.
Great. So who would do the actual, you know, punching out and putting them in another container?
So that happens at a licensed pharmacy that also has an extra designation as a charitable pharmacy. So it would be under the supervision of a pharmacist by pharmacy technicians.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Waiting to come up for your bill.
Thank you so much to the members of the committee.
Thank you so much. Anybody else want to be heard on LC 134? Seeing none, I'm going to close LC 134. Let's do the introductions, and then we'll do Lynn. That'll just take us 2 minutes. Is that okay?
Yes.
Great. All right, so I am going to open up a work session on introduction of committee legislative concepts. Is there a script? Would you like the script?
Chair Gelser, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 134 dated December 15th, 2015, LC 219 dated January 13th, 2016, LC 220 dated January 5th, 2016.
Vice Chair Olson moved that the legislative concepts as recited be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and the concepts are introduced as committee bills, and we'll get bill numbers on those soon, quickly. That's exciting. Great, and thank you for everybody. I again really want to compliment DOJ and DHS and the Alliance of Children's Programs and the foster youth, and so many people have put an extraordinary youth rights and justice, which is not to say everybody agrees with everything in it or has had the chance to read it all yet, but a lot of people have devoted a lot of time, and it's I'm really grateful for all of that. So now we are going to open up an informational hearing on the statewide mental health listening tour and its key themes. We have Lynn Saxton. And I think this is kind of a preview of a longer presentation we'll probably have later.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. We're very excited to be here today with a preview of the behavioral health tour that Senator Gelser and I and members of the Oregon Health Authority team, many legislators, many providers, and most importantly, many consumers in Oregon's behavioral health system participated in over the last 6 or 7 months. It's been an eye-opening and very helpful process for all of us. I think for me personally, and I think for many others, was very moving in terms of what we learned is top of mind for people being served in the behavioral health system across our state. So I don't know. Oh, there we go. So the tour, I want to underscore that when Senator Gelser talked to us about this work, one of the things we wanted to ensure that we did is both cover the state geographically, and as you can see from this slide, we had surprising attendance throughout, beginning in Klamath Falls in September. At OIT, we had 98 very engaged attendees, and you can see LeGrand, 77 people showing up in LeGrand.
That on a was, Friday night when there was a football game.
Exactly. Amazing. Bend, Astoria, again, when you see in Albany that we had 156 people, these were vibrant conversations, well attended, and it's important to underscore that we made an effort throughout in structuring our process to ensure that people could speak, and it wasn't about providers speaking, it wasn't about Senator Gelser and I speaking, it was about them speaking candidly and comfortably about what's really working for them in their lives and what challenges they face and what we can do to foster improved care and experience life experience for them. I want to underscore, because I'm really excited about this, we did a virtual session on December 14th, which was a virtual town hall with people calling in. It had this phenomenal AT&T employee who made sure virtually that everyone could speak, and it was really a great innovation on the part of the state of Oregon, and particularly because, first of all, for some people with behavioral health issues, being able to talk about their issues without being visible, and even though their voice is coming forward, they don't have to go somewhere if they have disabilities. They also don't have to take on that sometimes painful process of sitting with other people and talking about very sensitive issues. So that was attended by 32 participants. We actually had a lot more sign up, and the health authority itself is looking at using this approach in the future to capture member information.
And Lynn, if I could just add, what was remarkable about that AT&T employee, everybody called in, so it really replicated what we had done in person, where you had the small group conversations and then coming back together. So people broke up into these virtual rooms where they had small group conversations with a facilitator and 3 or 4 people, and then the whole big group would be brought back together again. It was, and the employee, we all wanted to take him home. He was so comforting.
Great. You're right, Senator Gelser. Thank you, because that was the strength of the format. This is a map of where we went in the state. As a 7-year resident of Klamath Falls, I just want to point out, when we scheduled these trips, I was called and someone said, why are you going to Klamath Falls? It's not in Southern Oregon. So it's important for everyone to see on the map that Klamath Falls is in Southern Oregon. Just have to say that. Okay, one of the things that I think produced a remarkable result was a lot of work on the front end, a lot of vision by Senator Gelser, and a lot of collaboration around how do we make this process not a complaint session, not a this kind of a traditional, this, you know, I need these things and we're not getting them, but how could we start with strengths-based practice with this population and say, tell us what's working for you? And those conversations were very poignant. I was sharing with one of my colleagues this morning the fact that people often said what they were most hopeful they could get in their lives were friends and social activities. And anyone who's worked with behaviorally health challenged folks, oftentimes their circle of social contact gets very small and isolated. Secondly, they talked a lot about the importance of employment for them to have a quality of life that they expect and other supports as well. So this is the question framework we use. We worked in small groups. After Klamath Falls, Senator Gelser and I and others did not sit at the tables to facilitate conversation. Several of the participants said they did not want to sit at tables with either their providers or their therapists or other people because they wanted to have freedom of voice. We worked very hard to achieve that, and I want to give a compliment to our CCO partners and our provider partners who respected members' desire to have space and freedom of speech, if you will, and sat in the room with us, were able to listen, but did not actively engage. So. Oh, is that it? Yep, that's it. Okay, so important points about where we go next. This is part of a three-legged stool we have been building over the last 12 months in Oregon as preamble to taking on our behavioral health challenges in this state, including at the CCO and county level, and we're very excited about that work. The first was the behavioral health mapping tool that the Oregon Health Authority began in February, which is a comprehensive data set based in counties in terms of resource allocation and outcomes of our behavioral health system, both in the CCO and the county deployment of those services. That work is underway. The Technical Advisory Committee convenes, which is people from all over the state, from all sectors, to verify and ensure that data is accurate and sound. They meet for the third time, I believe, next week, and will have a completed product in June of this year. That tool will be instrumental in helping us make informed investments for results for all populations in Oregon. And if any of you would like a briefing on the tool, we're happy to do that for you. Secondly, this tour, which we will be bringing forward a report in February, we have a preliminary report, which we were all very excited about. It's going to look a little different. It's going to have a data orientation, but it's also going to really communicate some themes from people that I think are going to be very compelling as we move forward to implement change in our behavioral health system. Thirdly, we have been working closely with the U.S. Department of Justice for the last 7 months. We had hoped to have our agreement by Christmas. That was one of my two Christmas presents I wanted. Unfortunately, we're still finishing that up, and we'll have it this month. But that agreement will frame some of the opportunities we have in the next 3 years to advance behavioral health results for Oregonians. I will be delivering to the governor a proposal for a process for behavioral health advances in January, and we'd be happy to share that with you as well once the governor's had a chance to review it. But this is really the cornerstone. I think many of the people who attended these town halls with perhaps a slightly skeptical eye came away not only impressed, but having a shift in their perception of needs and solutions that we need to get in place in Oregon. So with that, I'll stop. And again, I want to thank Senator Gelser for being on the road. This was a pretty aggressive travel schedule, people were very appreciative. We had senators and representatives. Senator Whitsitt and Representative Whitsitt joined us in Klamath Falls. Senator Knope joined us in Bend. We had a lot of active participation. Representative Greenlick was with us here in Portland. Senator Dembro, I know you were with us as well. So we appreciate everyone's time and effort to produce what I think will be a very critical element of moving forward with change. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to commend Lynn, who attended every single one of these. Lynn had a lot going on. You know, the day we went to Bend, she was coordinating responses to Umpqua Community College, and it's been a phenomenal opportunity to get to know Lynn and her team of facilitators, the individuals that went to every single one of these meetings and really engaged people. The feedback from people was that these facilitators made people feel so comfortable. And Cherie, who is our professional facilitator, was also extraordinary to keep the whole thing moving along.
Thank you. Our privilege. Thank
you. Any questions for?
I do have one question. Just, you know, putting on my workforce chair hat, you know, I'm intrigued by the comments about the workforce and the mm-hmm. challenges and the desires and expectations. And you know, at some point, I'd really like to tease those out and see if there aren't some things that we could be doing to make it easier for people to flourish in the workplace.
So, Chair Gelser, committee members, Senator Dembro, this is a matter of very close to my heart, and I have some direct experience working with employers to employ folks with chronic mental illness, and it can be truly transformative, and we look forward to advancing those initiatives. Thank you.
And then when we do present the report, when we do present the report in February, my hope is we can find a day and a room, but we've saved all of the post-it notes, which I noticed appeared in my office last night.
Oh, no.
There's a box that just says behavioral health town halls, and it's big and it's heavy, but it's got all of the flip charts with the actual words of people. And what I'm hoping is that we can get a room and have an open house there where folks can come and just get a sense of the words of these folks. And what I took away was this is the real story of real people in our state, and I'm so grateful that they gave us their time.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, so I'm going to close the informational hearing on the mental health tour. Anything else for the good of the order? See, nothing at all. We'll see you on February 1st. Do not plan on a 3-day weekend in February because we need that day.
Booey.
Sorry, Senator Olson. And with that, we are adjourned. We are adjourned. Sorry, Senator Olson. And with that,